Good evening and welcome to Peace Talk, a production for KTOO Radio's Focus on Community.
Once some guy went so far to say, try to imagine no heaven, no hell, and no God. No king, no country, not even possessions. We all thought he was asking a lie. So we kept on fighting for all of this stuff. But it never turned out to be reason enough to justify losing people we love. Yeah, that's what we did before the end of war. The end of war.
Peace Talk is a production by the Juneau Chapter of Veterans for Peace for KTOO Radio's Focus on Community. This is VFP's contribution to our ongoing conversation about war and peace and the important issues and questions they raise in our society and around the world. I'm Rich Moniak, your host for tonight's program. You'll be hearing veteran stories of trauma, survival, and personal courage as they try to change their world that caused them so much harm. These won't be classical war stories, and they won't be pleasant. They are about sexual assault in the military, and you may find a few of them extremely disturbing. Rebecca was an Army intelligence analyst, and this is her story.
I was born in Oklahoma, kind of grew up all over the place. I was an Army brat. My family was military, and if you're born in my family, you're pretty much born into a uniform. I always had like this calling to always be something bigger than myself. I come from a very traditional Native American family. I was always doing everything in the community. I became like the princess of my tribe. I was in school on a full academic scholarship. I was bound for med school. And then 9/11 happened, and I gave up my duties as the head princess. And I gave up tens of thousands of dollars in scholarship money. And then I went into the military. I was on cloud nine. It was the highlight of my life. I deployed to Iraq. The first day that I was there, I had these emails from somebody I had never met. He started coming around to my room all the time. If he wasn't at work, he would be on my door. Behind where we lived, there was a lot of open space where everybody would hang out. It was the middle of the night. People start leaving. Then it was just me and this other guy. We kept arguing about females being in the military. It eventually started to get physical. And then the next thing I know, this guy pushed and I was on the ground like in an instant. I came up and my head was just slammed like so hard into the concrete, and then there was incredible pain, so much pain. I could feel him on top of me. He wanted to have me in a sexual manner. I became absolutely petrified. He was going to kill me. Before I know it, I was up on his shoulders, and he was taking me to a dumpster. He was like, so women don't belong in combat, women don't belong in the military, you're all trash, all women are trash, and that's where you belong. And he threw me in a dumpster. I could feel my injuries swelling, like I could feel the back of my head just. I climbed out of the dumpster and walked back to the building. I didn't tell anybody exactly what happened. And the reason I didn't tell is the unwritten secret code of keep your mouth shut. I didn't want to lose my job. All I wanted to do was wake up every morning, be a service member, go to my job. That didn't happen. After I went back to my room, and those few weeks, I would come out of my room and I would look at the wall, and there's graffiti every day. Where's like whore and slut, and it had to be him. Eventually, we went to a different location. I felt a little better because the guy who had hurt me was gone. But then I started blacking out. I had these horrible pains that like shot through my eyes. And I was diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury in multiple locations. It finally took like a doctor sitting down and reading hundreds, possibly thousands of pages from several doctors to piece together. And eventually they were like, were you assaulted? I got into the TBI clinic, you know, eventually, but my unit wanted me to go off my own back, essentially. Their statement was, we are not refusing you medical treatment, but you need to take personal leave to go. I've been told there were other cases against my assailant. As far as I know, the guy only did, I think, maybe like 90 days in jail for DUI. Whatever type of violence that he inflicted upon another person, his jail time was for drinking and driving. I'm very fortunate that I sought help, which a lot of people are afraid to seek help. I started my organization, Walk Against Rape, and I focus a lot on service members because service members just have a lot of trouble getting medical help. And just because I'm out of my uniform doesn't mean that I'm still not serving my country.
Like Rebecca, most victims of sexual assault in the military choose not to file complaints. There are a lot of reasons for this, and we'll hear some of them from a former military prosecutor and judge. This was echoed in the independent investigative report released last week about sexual assault cases in the Alaska National Guard. In a Juneau Empire My Turn on Friday, Brigadier General Lori Hummel said that she felt anger and frustration over the findings. General Hummel is the Adjutant General of the Guard. She replaced Major General Thomas Katkus, who resigned last September after an early investigation revealed widespread abuse and a breakdown of the Guard's command structure under him. General Hummel offered a formal apology to the victims of this scandal, and she wrote that she was relieved that there were no new cases of sexual assault or abuse identified in the report. And of course, it's her responsibility to ensure it doesn't happen again. Now, I call this a scandal, and I think that's the proper term from a political perspective. It involved a dereliction of duty from the command at the ground level all the way to the governor's office. At the ground level, commanders either ignored complaints or created an atmosphere that was hostile to the victims. According to Guard chaplains who helped bring the crimes into daylight, General Katkus ignored them and enabled the command culture that discouraged reporting. And the governor trusted Katkus when history should have told him not to. But the word scandal can also be a distraction from the needs of the individual victims. And while fixing the political failures at all levels is vitally important, preventing further crimes is the ultimate goal. The history of criminal sexual behavior in America's armed forces goes way back, as you'll hear tonight. In 1991, the Tailhook scandal first exposed the culture which enables it. It was an aviator symposium in Las Vegas where more than 100 naval and marine officers were accused of sexually assaulting or committing indecent acts against more than 80 women. It was attended by the Secretary of the Navy, who actually claimed he saw nothing wrong while drinking beer on a patio right next to where the crimes were being committed. 25 years later, it's still a problem. In fact, a member of the armed forces is more likely to be sexually assaulted than any American civilian. What's at the root of this ugly epidemic? Studies point to the military's culture, structure, and environment that includes an emphasis on violence and hypermasculinity, a loss of individual identity, and the trained objectification or dehumanization of others. Tackling any of these is a challenge, but nothing can be fixed without acknowledging the crimes are indeed widespread. What has prevented that, or attempted to prevent that, seems to be a combination of the command culture and a military justice system that is nothing like what's practiced in the civilian world. Colonel Don Christensen was a military prosecutor for 14 years. Four of those years, he was the Air Force's chief prosecutor. He personally tried about 40 sexual assault cases and supervised the prosecution of 300 more. He was tough and he got convictions. But he's been on both sides of the courtroom in these kinds of cases. Before becoming a prosecutor, his ability to get acquittals or dismissals gave him a reputation as being one of the very best defense attorneys for any soldier accused of rape. On these matters, Christensen knows better than most what's wrong with the military justice system. He spoke about it at a press conference in December with New York Senator Christian Gillibrand.
After 23 years of seeing how our military process is often there to deny justice to victims while protecting their predators, it is time for fundamental military justice reform. I wholeheartedly agree with reforms starts by making independent military prosecutors responsible for the decision of whether serious crimes such as rape, murder, and sexual assault should be prosecuted and what those charges should be. Many Americans would be surprised to find out that somebody other than a prosecutor makes that decision in the Air Force. Currently, we have a system of justice unlike any other in the United States, in which a person who is not a lawyer and without specialized training or significant experience in military justice or criminal investigations makes these weighty decisions. In the military, a commander serving as a convening authority makes the call of whether a case should go forward or not, what the charges will be, and who sits on the jury. The convening authority is not legally trained. He's an officer with an entirely different skill set, usually in waging armed conflict, such as a ship captain, and an infantry officer. For that skill set, they bring decades of training and experience, and in that they excel. The same cannot be said for military justice. They do not possess the skills required to determine the complexity of the right course of action and allegations of criminal misconduct, especially sexual assault and rape. It takes years of experience to become proficient in the prosecution of complex cases. By the time I became the Chief Prosecutor of the United States Air Force, I had tried over 150 courts-martial and presided over another 100 as a military judge. I had 19 years of experience when I took the job, and I was still learning things about prosecuting sexual assault. It is simply unfair to victims and to the accused that a convening authority makes these weighty calls based on only a few hours of legal training. It is unfair to the commanders to put them in this position as well. It is a system set up for failure.
And it's obviously not just set up to fail. The track record of failures is long. The reform that Colonel Christensen is advocating is known as the Military Justice Improvement Act. It was first proposed 2 years ago by Senator Gillibrand. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski was one of the co-sponsors. It was endorsed by VFP, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, Vietnam Veterans of America, Service Women's Action Network, the National Women's Law Center, Protect Our Defenders, and the National Task Force to End Sexual and Domestic Violence Against Women. But the bill died on the Senate floor when some Senate Republicans threatened a filibuster. A reform sponsored by Senator Claire McCaskill did pass, but it did not include the important provision that would have transferred the decision to prosecute sexual assault in the military from commanders to military prosecutors outside the chain of command. But Senator Gillibrand hasn't given up. Armed with new evidence from the Department of Defense and Human Rights Watch, she is gearing up to offer an amendment to the 2016 National Defense Appropriation Act. Here is Senator Gillibrand speaking on the Senate floor this month.
Over the last few years, Congress has forced the military to make incremental changes to address the crisis of sexual assault. After two decades of complete failure and lip service to zero tolerance, the military now says, essentially, trust us, we've got it this time. They spin the data, hoping nobody will dig below the surface of their top lines, because when you do, you will find that the assault rate is exactly where it was in 2010. We see an average of 52 new cases every day. 3 out of 4 service members who are survivors still don't think it's worth the risk of coming forward to report these crimes committed against them. 1 in 7 victims was actually assaulted by someone in their chain of command. And 60% of cases, the survivor says a unit leader or supervisor is responsible for sexual harassment or gender discrimination. So it's no surprise then that 1 in 3 survivors believe that reporting would hurt their career. For those who do report, they are more likely than not to experience retaliation. Despite the much-touted reform that made retaliation a crime, the DOD has made zero progress on improving on the 62% retaliation rate that we had in 2012. So 2012, 62% of those who reported their crime against them were retaliated against for doing so. In 2014, again, 62% were retaliated against. Now, Human Rights Watch looked into these figures and into these stories, and they found that the DOD could not provide a single example from the last year where disciplinary action was actually taken against someone for retaliation. A sexual assault survivor is 12 times more likely to suffer retaliation than see their offender get convicted of sexual assault. And in my close review of 107 cases from 2013 from our 4 largest military bases, one for each service, I found that nearly half of those who did move forward to report in an unrestricted report, half of them withdrew from their case during the first year. So we can talk all we want about reporting. Well, if half of those who report withdraw during the year of the prosecution, it shows there's no faith in the system. Survivors do not have faith in the current system. Under any metric, the system remains plagued with distrust and does not provide fair and just process that survivors deserve. Simply put, the military has not held up to the standard posed by General Dempsey 1 year ago when he said the Pentagon was on the clock. I urge my colleagues to hold the military to this higher standard. Let us put these decisions into the hands of trained military prosecutors. Enough is enough with the spin, with the excuses, and with false promises. We have to do the right thing, and we have to act.
To emphasize what Senator Gillibrand is saying, the right thing is to take away from commanders the power to decide whether or not a sexual assault case goes to trial. And that means taking the staff judge advocate out of the picture, too. As Colonel Christensen explains, they are usually junior officers serving under the commanding officer. That means they're not independent. And he says that they have little of the right kind of experience for advising anyone how to proceed on these kind of cases. Their role is to advise commanders about other legal issues, such as contract law and environmental law. And then he talks about commander biases, because the alleged rapist usually works under him as well. Colonel Christensen's arguments are long and confusing to a layperson, but he does offer a clear analogy of how poorly structured the military justice system is in crimes of this nature.
If I could explain military justice this way, imagine, if you will, an employee at Walmart. That employee is raped by a popular store manager, maybe someone who is employee of the year. The victim is brave and she reports the rape to the police. Now imagine that the police work for the store's corporate headquarters and that the CEO for the store will make the decision on whether the case will be prosecuted. In making that decision, the CEO will not consult the local district attorney. Instead, he will ask his in-house counsel whether it's in the best corporate interest to prosecute the case. Imagine the DA did not make the decision whether or not to prosecute the case. Imagine that even if the CEO allowed the case to go forward, that the district attorney would not determine the charges, would not determine whether there should be a pretrial agreement or anything else, a plea bargain, that the CEO would do that. And the CEO would pick the jury. And that everybody in the jury would be an employee of Walmart. And finally, imagine that the rapist's co-workers were allowed to come before that jury and say what a great employee he was. And based upon that alone, the jury would be instructed that the fact that he was a great asset to Walmart, a great employee, would be a basis to find him not guilty. Could that victimized employee expect justice in that case? I think the answer is no. Now, if you change Walmart to Air Force Base, CEO to convening authority, and store manager to pilot, that is our military justice system. It's a miracle that the small percentage of victims who do come forward actually do.
Now remember, Senator Gillibrand said 3 out of 4 victims of sexual assault in the military don't think it's worth reporting the crime. We'll hear some of those stories later in the program. What happens to those that do seek justice in the military system? Senator Gillibrand described a retaliation rate of 62%. And you heard her say that the Department of Defense could not provide a single example of where anyone was held accountable for retaliating against a victim who dared to speak up. I mentioned Colonel Christensen's concerns about commander biases. He explains how that branches out to others in the unit and leaves the victim without support.
If you really knew what victims went through when they walk into a military courtroom, walk by their coworkers, their bosses, their commanders, their first sergeants, their leaders, all sitting behind her rapist, you would understand why we need to do things differently in the military.
Now think again about Gillibrand's statement on the retaliation rate against victims who report assaults. Those figures describe overt actions. It doesn't include social retaliation that occurs when a victim's peers choose sides in the courtroom. Everything is stacked against the victim. They are almost all alone if they choose to fight for justice. But as we've been hearing, the majority of sexual assault, abuse, and harassment are never reported. As Rebecca said in her story at the beginning of the show, there's a perception of an unwritten code of keep your mouth shut. Don't complain if you want a career in the military. Terry Youngs is a victim who had a 20-year career because she didn't complain. Now she's speaking out for justice for military victims. Terry joined the Navy at the age of 19. During her 20 years of service, she worked in aviation administration and headed the technical libraries of maintenance departments. She was a lead CPR instructor and served on the board of directors for the local Red Cross. She also served on numerous morale and welfare committees and mentored young women new to the military. I spoke with Terry last week, and this is what happened to her.
I joined the military in 1976. When I left boot camp, I was raped by a civilian on my way to my first duty station. I never told anybody about it. It was something that I was very ashamed of. So I went on with my military life. I spent 20 years in the military, but that incident and the damage that it did followed me through my 20-year career. My story comes mostly from the harassment, because after somebody is raped, they are harassed, and it's brutal. The military makes it very brutal. The hardest thing that happened to me was when I was confronted by a warrant officer when I was stationed in Memphis, Tennessee, and he decided that he didn't like women in his Navy. And so he very quietly took me out onto a hangar deck and where there was no one around, and he very specifically said, "I am going to see to it that you are administratively discharged from the military." And that's where my life really started to spin out of control. He was bringing me up on legal charges, and they were putting me in different work sections, and they were just doing anything they could to make my life difficult. After I retired, I went to the VA because I felt like I was having some emotional issues. And I was diagnosed with PTSD at that time in 2001. And I was really reluctant to take on that title of having PTSD. I went to the San Jose VA, and there was a wonderful psychologist there, and she had set up a PTSD clinic where we had a women's group. And this women's group brought us together and told us that we were not alone, that my story was their story. We were in different services. We were in different places in the world. we were at different times, yet my story was their story was my story. We went in one day for our therapy session, and we were told, this is the last therapy session you're going to have. This clinic is closing down. And that's really where I came into becoming an advocate, because we fought that tooth and nail. We went to the press. We went to the VA. And everywhere we went, there was no relief. And so we were pretty much kicked to the curb.
Even though Terry's group failed to keep her clinic from closing, she wasn't done fighting. Like others, she found new strength after disclosing a traumatic sexual assault. We'll hear more from Terry in a few minutes. But now I want to emphasize how psychological healing is empowering. Getting there begins by breaking the resistance to admitting something is wrong inside us. Not with us. Post-traumatic stress is not a disorder that says we're defective. It's our inner voice seeking help. And once we accept that, it's like Terry learned. We're not alone. And that doesn't necessarily mean we need to be among others with similar experiences. It's about learning that most family, friends, and others won't judge us less because of the trauma we endured. It's often said that what doesn't kill us makes us stronger. That doesn't just mean we're capable of surviving something worse. Living is more than a matter of survival, but being fully alive also comes with the full restoration of our vulnerability. We are never safe, but we are free from the restraints of fear. It's a model that by itself can help others face their present difficulties and painful past with hope. A decade ago, I met a young woman who, for me, epitomized what I'm trying to say. As a young teenager, she had been raped numerous times by a family member. She didn't act like a victim. She had the spirit of a warrior, but the soul of a student seeking peace. She fought to stay in command when facing her fears, but she knew that being in control was an illusion. In a way, she became my teacher. One of her inspirations was singer-songwriter Tori Amos, who was raped at knife point when she was 21. She never told anyone. Several years later, after watching Thelma and Louise, a film very much about the culture of rape, Amos wrote the song, Me and a Gun, and performed it live a few hours later. In an interview a few years after that, she said, quote, I really do feel as though I was psychologically mutilated that night, and that now I'm trying to put the pieces back together again, through love, not hatred, and through my music. My strength has been to open again, to life, and my victory is the fact that, despite it all, I kept alive my vulnerability. End quote. Here's Tori Amos singing Me and a Gun. I dedicate this to all of those who have found the strength to open the door to life after being raped.
5 a.m. Friday morning, Thursday night, far from sleep. I'm still up and driving, can't go home, obviously. So I'll just change direction, 'cause they'll soon know where I live. And I wanna live, got a full tank and some chips, with me and a gun and a man on my back. And I sang holy, holy as he buttoned down his pants. You can laugh, it's kind of funny, things you think times like these. Like I haven't seen Barbados, so I must get out of this. Yes, I wore a slinky red thing. Does that mean I should spread for you, your friends, your father, Mr. Ed, with me and a gun and a man on my back? But I haven't seen Barbados, so I must get out of this. And I know what this means. Me and Jesus, a few years back, used to hang. And he said, it's your choice, babe. Just remember, I don't think you'll be back in 3 days' time. So you choose well. Tell me what's right. Is it my right to be on my stomach? A fretzville. It's me and a gun and a man on my back. But I haven't seen Barbados, so I must get out of this. And do you know Carolina, where the biscuits are soft and sweet? These things go through your head when there's a man on your back. You'll push flat on your stomach. It's not a classic Cadillac. Me and a gun and a man on my back. But I haven't seen Barbados, so I must get out of this. I haven't seen Barbados, so I must get out of this.
You're listening to Peace Talk, a Veterans for Peace production on KTOO FM in Juneau. I'm Rich Moniak, and I've been bringing to you stories about sexual assault in the military and the efforts to change the system of military justice for the sake of victims who fear reporting, who are often retaliated against, and who rarely get a fair trial when they do take their case to court. Before listening to Tori Amos sing about being raped, you heard Terry Young's personal story. She left off with describing how, 2 decades after she was raped, the VA clinic that was helping her was closed. Here's what happened next.
When Facebook came about, when social media came about, everybody was able to connect, and everybody was able to say, okay, this is what happened to me. It took off from there, especially when they came out with the report that there were over 26,000 unwanted sexual contacts made in 2013, and my friend Victoria Sanders is the one that dreamed up the 26,000 letter project. And the point of the project was to get 26,000 letters, one for each one of those unwanted sexual contacts, and take them to Congress. We weren't able to get 26,000 letters, but we got 160 letters, and they were very powerful letters, and we delivered those to DC. And we've heard back from the people that we delivered letters for, that they have now have heard back from their congressman. And we were told that the offices in D.C. were coming to Gillibrand's office going, hey, these people are making noise. And they're going, what can we do? And they came to us and they said, please, you know, keep your people calling, keep your people emailing, keep your people tweeting, because you're being heard.
So the idea is to get the unheard stories of victims to Congress. But rather than reading from the collection that Terry and her friend Vicky have pulled together, I'm going to bring you one told by the victim herself. Like Rebecca's story at the start of the show, it was recorded by the Protect Our Defenders group. A little warning, this isn't suitable for a young audience. Aviation Commander Darshell is one of the few women who filed a formal complaint, and her case went to trial. Here is her story.
I had a very happy childhood. My father was Army for a very long time. I didn't know what regular time was. It was always military time. So I would say 1300 and the other kids wouldn't know what I was saying. I didn't join the military until I was 30. It was always something that I wanted to do. I wanted to show my sons the example of what my father showed me as a young girl. It was about a month into my service that I started receiving unwanted comments from a superior there. It escalated to where he grabbed me by the top of my head and he pushed my head into his genital area while telling me what my lips would feel like. After the investigation, he was flown off of the ship and he was removed of his rank. Rumors started spilling out, and the treatment that I received after that was that it was my fault that I took his rank from him. I was now the person that was going to go to someone else's division and empty their water bucket, or I was now going to work nights. I just felt like I had to get away from it all to actually start brand new. I decided to move my children and I to Italy. And I went there as an aviation administration man. They immediately saw that I had experience and, you know, requested that I actually take over that particular program. And I gladly accepted. There was a coworker. He was a real genuine friend. He came over and joined us to cook. I told everyone good night. I went upstairs to my room and I locked the door. I was very startled when the door opened. I heard the voice of my coworker. I got scared.
Right off, he actually tried to put his... in my mouth, and I refused to open. I just kept my mouth closed, and I closed my eyes really, really tight. It didn't matter to him.
As he was attempting to penetrate me, I heard my son at the door, and the way he darted to that door, I was afraid that he was going to hurt. But he barricaded the door to keep my son from coming in. And he explained to my son that he was taking care of me. I did not want my children to know, but my son walked all the way up there to the front gate and notified security. The NCIS agents assured me, "We have never had this much evidence." They had pictures of the door where he actually maneuvered the lock to get into my room. They had my clothing where my zipper was broken and his fingerprints on my articles of clothing. They had his DNA on my comforter. They found his DNA inside my rape kit. He was still found not guilty of anything. And the explanation that I got, and I quote, "It's no question that his genitals touch your genital area, but it's reasonable to believe that he had your consent." I received the blue jacket of the quarter, which basically is when they award who was the best of that particular quarter. I had to submit a PTS, and it's basically where you ask, "Can you reenlist?" My PTS came back denied, which was very shocking for me as well as for my superiors. I accepted the fact that the military was now done with me, and I went back to school. I received my master's degree, which was very exciting. I took the opportunity to show my children that I was not completely beaten. I had to get my life back.
When Terry and Vicky took their letters to Congress, they met Amy. Together, they attended a DOD judicial panel hearing on the prevention and response to retaliation against victims of sexual assault crimes. Terry was scheduled to testify there, but she gave up her spot so the panel could hear Amy's disturbing but powerful story. Here is Terry introducing Amy.
Before we went to D.C., I was on Facebook one day, and she made contact with me and said, "Hi, you know, I'm Amy, and I'm going to be going to D.C., and I'd kind of like to meet you guys." When we got there, we called her and said, "Hey, come on over." She was in the Navy. She was stationed on a ship. She is a military wife. She lives at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and she is an extremely intelligent woman and is going to be getting her master's and her PhD. She is bound and determined that she's going to help people that have been raped in the military. I was actually supposed to testify, but I felt that Amy's story was so powerful and so heartbreaking that she needed to get her story out there. So I gave up my time to her.
Now here is Amy's story as she told it to the DOD judicial panel.
I joined the military in 2002. I was inspired to serve my country in the wake of 9/11. I began my service as an aviation electrician. I felt it clear to me that my obligation as an American, and from my point of view, my obligation to God, was to help my nation stronger in any way I could. My desire to make a positive difference is the reason why I've received multiple awards of service. I was young and idealistic when I signed up, and despite what happened to me, I remain idealistic, and I continue to believe in our country, our democracy, and the value that we place on the right and doing the right thing. I do realize that we have progressed as a nation, increasingly living up to our own ideas like the spirit and quality in our Declaration of Independence. Helping our military system live up to these American values and creating an environment where military personnel respect and support each other can only make us stronger. It was not easy for me to come forward to tell my story. Ultimately, I determined I needed to, despite my reluctance and embarrassment, to help to do justice for many survivors who have endured the same pain as myself. So here it is. During my time in service, I was repeatedly assaulted, verbally, physically, sexually. I was raped 3 times. I was considered fair game since there was no consequences for the rapist, not even a slap on the wrist. That was the culture I joined. That was the reality I had joined in order to serve my country. The reaction of my command was always to consider me a troublemaker while neglecting the perpetrators of what obviously was a crime and equally obviously does not work to build a strong and cohesive military team built on support. Instead of supporting me in any way, my command master chief, whose name is David Orso, who ironically is now working for the VA, told the upper enlisted personnel to keep an eye on me to ensure that I didn't quote-unquote make trouble. Allowing rape to go unaddressed in a 21st century world is barbaric in itself. Certainly the neglect and injustice does not build loyalty or respect. But I was a victim of other crimes too, for the command laughed off and covered up, for example. In October 2004, as a part of VF-32, I was deployed on the Truman to support Operation Enduring Freedom. At one point, I had learned my brother had been shot in the face, and I had went to medical to get a sedative or something to help me sleep because I was not sleeping. On top of the stress I had already been feeling as a woman in constant jeopardy under a male command that didn't seem to care, the news about my brother was extremely unsettling. As a result of the sedative, I fell asleep on a chair during message to us from the ship's captain's communication system. My shipmates sprayed my body with aircraft cleaner and lit me on fire. I woke up engulfed in flames. I had actually been set on fire. That so-called prank could have cost me my life. I ran to medical right away, and fortunate not to have been physically scarred forever, but still live with the nightmares to this day. When I complained about the dangerous treatment, Senior Chief Peña Cruz told me just to be quiet and not to overreact. What happens in the civilian life if one person sets another on fire? A lot more than laughter. After this incident, my command moved me to corrosion control, where my direct supervisor in aviation maintenance was at AM1 ATE. During the first week of working under his supervision, he came up to me, grabbed my breast, and said, "If you were my country, Ghana, we would cut your clit off because women don't deserve pleasure. Would you consider that appropriate supervision?" Ate continued to make unwanted advances and threatening comments for about 2 more weeks. Did my command give Ate guidance on becoming a better manager? No. They simply changed my shift and gave me no sign of caring and no support at all. While forced to stay in corrosion, I did everything in my power to switch shops, jobs, and commands. Following these reports, Chief Petty Officer Darby came up to me on the flight deck and choked me. I ran and towed someone. They told me to drop it. They didn't care. Ultimately, I called a captain's mess in November 2004, where I spoke about everything that I had been enduring, and the medical staff, whose job was to protect the patients, had been breaking HIPAA laws by telling my command everything I was telling them in a private conversation. As what has been revealed as a shameful, widespread pattern of military cover-ups, he diagnosed me with borderline personality disorder while continuing to say I was fit for full duty. After voicing my concerns at captain's mess, I was told simply, "Now you just need to be saying you're satisfied." In January 2005, I was processed off the ship for a so-called mental defect. I defy any of you not to have mental consequences if you were raped, harassed repeatedly, and set on fire while management looked the other way and just left.
Now, if any member of Congress can listen to that story, can listen to Amy's voice break as she tells it, and not be brought to rage and tears at the same time, then they don't belong in Washington, D.C. But like Tori Amos described, Amy's coming forward is on the path to healing. As more women do, they're paving the way for others to feel safe to follow them. And not only that, these women have become the model for men to come forward too. Here's Terry educating me about an entirely different side of this epidemic in our military.
Most people do not realize that 53% of sexual assaults in the military are against men. Men on men.
And this is a Department of Defense finding?
Yes, absolutely. Men are just now starting to come out saying, yes, this happened to me.
When GQ magazine researched this a few years ago, they spoke with James Ashbrand, a VA psychologist who worked at a PTSD clinic. He said, quote, "One of the myths is that the perpetrators identify as gay, which is by and large not the case," end quote. With no one reporting, who knows how long it's been going on, but clearly it has nothing to do with Don't Ask, Don't Tell or its repeal. If this predates Clinton's presidency or goes back to the Vietnam War era, you can imagine how many veterans are suffering from sexual assault trauma that they've never disclosed. Here is Heath telling his story.
I was planning on spending my life in the military. That was my whole ambition since I was a child. All my family, both sides, were all in the military. My dad's ex-army, my stepfather's ex-army. When I first joined the Navy, it was 5 days after my 17th birthday. I was in boot camp. Believe it or not, I was pampered. I was pampered in boot camp because I was so young. Everybody looked out for me. Everybody tried helping me so I would make it. It was like a big family. I showed up for duty on the holiday weekend in September. And they told me, oh, you didn't have to be here yet. They had nobody that was really able to show me where to go, what to do. And there was a couple guys that were like, well, hey, you're new, why don't you come hang out with us? So we went to New York City, hung out at the Army and Navy Hotel. I ended up passing out, waking up with somebody tugging my pants off, and another person standing above me ejaculating on my face. And the one that was trying to pull my pants off was trying to grab at my genitals. And I freaked out. I didn't know it was, wow. And I got up, I ran in the bathroom, locked myself in there, kept washing my face. Didn't sleep the rest of the night. Next morning, I took a bus back to the ship, reported it and got told I was a liar, that I just wanted to go back home. And the master at arms that I spoke to told me that he would speak with these gentlemen about it. And after he did that, my life turned to hell. They started bullying me. They would rob me. They would beat me. And every single time I complained, the assaults escalated worse. They got more aggressive. Instead of getting smacked in the face, I'd be waking up with them pulling my clothes off me, trying to shove their penis in my anus, trying to make me give them oral sex. And it was horrible. And this was within a month of time. And I tried committing suicide. I got caught in the middle of trying to do it. And I called home and I was upset. And my family's like, leave. Come home. So I did. I came home and we went straight to meet a congressman. And I told my story to him. And his advice was, don't go back yet. I'm going to investigate this. The police started looking for me because I was AWOL. So I started living on the streets because I didn't want my mom or my dad to get in trouble because I was in their home. And I ended up getting caught. I got arrested. I was stealing hot dogs out of a store. And they sent me to jail. And that's when they found out who I was. And I was a basket case. I was a wreck. This was done by a forensic social worker from while I was incarcerated. And she basically writes in here to her belief that I'm suffering from intense psychological pain and continue to express symptoms typical to people who have been victimized and raped. I was picked up by the Navy officials. They took me to the brig, which is like a naval jail, and then they transferred me back to the ship that I was on. Some of the people that did the stuff to me weren't gone, and some of them had got caught molesting other people while I was gone. When I came back, it was worse. The gang of molesters decided one time that they were going to ransack me while I was in the shower, beat the crap out of me, shoved me on the ground, tried shoving a bottle of shampoo up me. Then they ended up proceeding to get a toilet bowl cleaner and ended up raping me with a toilet bowl cleaner. I ended up going to the ship's doctor. I was bleeding. He told me it was fine. It was probably just hemorrhoids or something. And just don't worry about it. I don't have to work for the day and go back to work the next day. And that's what I dealt with. And these guys kept getting away with this. And I got to the point, I could not do it. So I left. I turned myself in. The captain came and talked to me. He says, well, I'm going to hook you up with a lawyer because I think you need to be represented because we're going to take you and court-martial you. I met with this lawyer. He says, well, we got two choices. He goes, we can go to your court-martial. They're going to give you 6 months confinement to the ship. He says, I don't think you need that. He goes, how about we ask him for another honorable discharge? He says, he'll be right out. He says, he'll be gone within a week. Okay, I'll do that. I'm just turning 18, you know. I was at the mental state where you could have gave me a death certificate for me to sign, and I would have signed it. I went to the VA hospital in Syracuse for my post-traumatic stress disorder, and they denied me due to the fact that my discharge. So I appealed their decision. 7 days after I appealed their decision, my VA benefits and rights were taken away. I admit to going AWOL. I know it was wrong. But them not helping me to keep me from being sexually assaulted, terrorized, beat, robbed, I had my reasons why I went AWOL. I don't know anybody in their right state of mind who wouldn't have done the same thing if they were in my shoes. I'm speaking out now partially because I'm upset about how I've been treated. Also because I don't think that other people that have had this happen to them should stay hidden anymore. I think we all need to speak out. There's unity in voices. We can move mountains together if we pushed. If we stay hidden, we're not going to get anywhere. Every single time I talk about this, I feel like I'm shedding a piece of skin off me that has been holding me in. And yeah, it hurts. But afterwards, the calm is so much better than that hurt.
The underlying theme of the stories we've been listening to is a broken military justice system compounded by a long-lived culture of indifference and denial. Earlier in the show, we heard Senator Gillibrand accuse the top brass in the military of acting with a trust us, we've got it attitude, while they spin the data and hope no one digs below the surface. Let's listen to her describe another side of the scandal that's not part of their reports to Congress, and it's something they've been hiding from the American public.
Every time we look at this problem, it seems to get worse. My office just reviewed 107 sexual assault case files from the largest base from each of the services. We requested these files, and that was for 1 year of sexual assault. We requested this data to understand what actually happens once the reports are filed, how they're investigated, how they move forward within the military justice system to see if there's any other challenges we have to address. It took the Pentagon a year to respond to my document request. These 107 files were just a snapshot of the thousands of estimated cases that occur annually. What we found, which was unexpected, was an alarming rate of assault among two survivor groups that are not represented in the DOD survey. The DOD survey is all service members. But what we found is that civilian women and military spouses are not counted in that survey. And of these 107 cases, 53%, the survivor was either a military spouse or a civilian. These two categories of survivors are hidden in the shadows. According to the DOD themselves, the real scope of this problem, unfortunately, is much larger than the 20,000 that were estimated for last year alone. These obviously aren't just numbers. These are real lives being broken, and they deserve a fair shot at justice.
Every American deserves an honest and fair justice system. You can help fix what's broken on the military side by contacting your senators and representative in Congress and telling them to support the Military Justice Improvement Act. And after they pass it, they need to keep working to end the epidemic of sexual assault in the military. Thank you for joining me on Peace Talk tonight. The program was brought to you by the Juneau Chapter of Veterans for Peace and KTOO Radio. Several of the stories you heard tonight were recorded by Protect Our Defenders, a nonprofit human rights organization dedicated to giving a voice to the brave women and men in uniform who have been raped or sexually assaulted by fellow service members. The full press conference where Colonel Christensen spoke and Senator Gillibrand's speeches are available online at our Comprehensive Resource Center for the Military Justice Improvement Act. I'm Rich Moniak. Have a good night.